It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 35 degrees under fair skies. At the airport, they are showing northwest winds to 15, gusting to 23, and they have 10 full miles of visibility. The Weather Service is looking for sunny skies for the rest of the week. Northwest winds about 15 or so for today and tomorrow, coming up to 20 or 25 Tuesday night and gusting as high as 35 on Wednesday. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Kodiak City Council approved all its resolutions at its regular meeting on Thursday night. The Kodiak High School dance team recently got back from a college football bowl game that was a long time coming. And seafood processor Peter Pan has announced it will not operate its King Cove facility until spring. Those stories plus lead pipes after national headlines.
Live from NPR News at the Iowa caucuses, I'm Jack Speer. It is a balmy 1 degree here in West Des Moines, Iowa, where several hours from now caucus goers will be coming to this location. It's really the kickoff of the process of the months-long Republican presidential primary process. NPR's Don Gagne joins me live. So, Don, why are all eyes focused on Iowa here?
This is where the election season officially begins. The action in Iowa is all on the Republican side. Polls have consistently shown that Donald Trump is the favorite, a lead in the range of 30 points. There'll be lots of attention paid to see if he actually performs that well, but the big battle will likely be for second place between former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Whoever comes in second will try to use that as a boost into future states.
So you've been here for a few days. Briefly, how does this caucus process work? It's very different from what other states do.
Yes. At each caucus site in the state, there are more than 1,600 of them. People need to be in place by 7 p.m. local time. A caucus captain makes remarks, calls on any representatives of the various candidates who might like to make a short speech. After that, voting begins. To do so, caucus participants simply put an X next to the name of their preferred candidate on a small sheet of paper. It's put in a box. When the votes are hand-counted, we hopefully, within a couple hours, get results.
NPR's Don Gagne joining us. Thanks, Don. The blizzard is over, meanwhile, but it is bitterly cold here in Iowa. Wind chill warnings are up. It could affect tonight's turnout. Sheila Brummer is with Iowa Public Radio and has more.
Communications Director for the Republican Party of Iowa, Kush Desai, says the weather is obviously a concern as people head out to caucus tonight, but he didn't seem overly worried.
Iowans are Midwesterners. We're used to the winters. We've had caucuses for a half century now, through snow, through rain, through freezing temperatures.
Temperatures will be cold, with the National Weather Service predicting sub-zero weather and wind chills as low as 45 below, likely making for the coldest caucus night on record. Desai advised caucus goers to give themselves enough time to make it to precinct sites safely. For NPR News, I'm Sheila Brummer, Sioux City, Iowa.
The Iowa caucus process is unique in its own way, though who will turn out tonight remains unclear. Some caucus goers are not backing the apparent frontrunner, according to polls, former President Donald Trump. Betsy Sarcone is a real estate agent here in West Des Moines. She supports Nikki Haley.
I think that Nikki Haley's right on when she says the chaos that we're in cannot move forward. And I agree with her. The world's on fire with everything going on right now, and he is not the smart choice to lead us forward.
On the minds of voters here, the economy, foreign policy, and border security, among other factors. You're listening to NPR.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Kodiak City Council unanimously approved all its resolutions at a regular meeting on Thursday night. Those included changes for the Baranoff Park Improvements Project, an upgraded system connecting Kodiak's wastewater and water treatment plants, among other business items. The city committed to paying $5 million for the Baranoff Park Recreation Center back in 2022, and as of this week, the construction is just over 90% complete. But City Manager Mike Fenge says the contractor requires an additional $130,000 to finish overhauling Baranoff Park.
The siding and the roofing installation, the electrical and plumbing rough-ins, our sprinkler system, our fire alarm system, and the ventilation are all complete. As of yesterday, the contractor is just finishing up those offices on the north side of the building, including the locker rooms and our bathrooms.
Based on a report from the city manager, the work with the Kodiak-based Friend contractors was originally due to be completed by the end of October last year. Then it was pushed back to late December. Now it's listed as mid-February. The Department of Parks and Recreation is slated to take over operation of the ice rink contained within the Baranoff Park facility on or about February 15th. In other business Thursday night, the council authorized $90,000 worth of upgrades to the wastewater treatment plant supervisory control and data acquisition system, also known as SCADA. The upgrades will create a more secure network, establish a separate fiber communication link between the Pillar Mountain Water Treatment Plant and the wastewater treatment plant at Spruce Cave, as well as set up redundant servers in two locations. City Manager Mike Tvingi says upgrading the SCADA system will make it easier to monitor water flow and potential breaks through the whole system of lift stations and water treatment plants. Councilmember Richard Walker said it will also benefit workers at the facilities.
It's also good for safety for our guys working out in the field. The SCADA systems will let us know what's going on, where in the old days they didn't have anything telling them what was going on, and they had to go crawling down 60 to 90 feet down inside of a wet well.
Alaska Communications will conduct the work to upgrade the SCADA system, which includes building the fiber optic cable link, trenching and backfill, along with pavement removal and replacement at two separate locations in town. Before adjourning the meeting, the council also appointed members of the public to various commissions and advisory boards, including the Ports and Harbor Advisory Board. Kodiak's City Council will next meet January 25th. The Kodiak High School dance team recently got back from a college football bowl game. It was in Florida, and they performed in front of tens of thousands of people. KMXT's Brian Venois reports the show was years in the making.
Sarah Nugent is the head coach of the Kodiak dance team and has worked with students for about a decade. She says she made contact with a group that organizes performances at college football games about 5 years ago.
In 2019, we decided to bring a camp to us because it was cheaper than trying to fly everybody out of state to attend a summer camp.
The dance team decided to find someone from out of state and contacted Just for Kicks, a company that helps plan dance camps and sells dance attire. Nugent says after they got in contact, the owner, Cindy Clow, decided to visit Kodiak herself.
When she heard that we wanted to do a home camp here in Alaska, rather than send employees, she decided to come herself because she had never been to Alaska.
Nugent says Clow and her team were so impressed, they invited the dancers to perform at a college pregame and halftime show in the winter of 2019. But flights are expensive, so they pushed it back to 2020 to give themselves more time to fundraise. Then the COVID-19 pandemic struck and delayed travel once again. Reagan Diemer is a high school senior and a captain of the Kodiak dance team. She says they were supposed to travel and perform at a football game last winter.
We're like, all right, guys, this is a new record. We did it. We're actually at the airport.
But then a blizzard in Seattle canceled several flights in the lower 48 that would have prevented them from getting to all the rehearsals, so they didn't make it out of Kodiak.
Last year they canceled it the day before. They gave us another chance to go. Like, we were able to leave. We were all either unpacked or we were all in the middle of doing things like showering and things like that, that we were not able to just get up and run.
Then the dance team tried again just last month over the students' winter break and made it to Florida in time to do 8 days of training and to explore the city. Diemer says they got to perform with hundreds of other high schoolers from around the country.
It was definitely inspiring because I was able to match skill level with some people, and you're also never going to see these people again, so our confidence was like definitely boosted.
They performed a pregame show and the halftime show in front of an audience of over 30,000 people. The Kodiak dance team is now celebrating its 40th year of working with the island students. Nugent says she's grateful for the community's support over the years and that she's hoping to plan more big trips soon. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
Seafood processor Peter Pan announced on Thursday that it will not operate its King Cove facility until spring. KDLG's Christina McDermott has more.
The plant is Peter Pan's largest in Alaska and processes some of the most lucrative and largest fisheries in the U.S., including pollock and salmon. In a press release, Peter Pan said that it, along with other seafood processors, was contending with cost and cash flow problems, including inflation, rising interest rates, high fuel costs, and financing problems. The company added that the decision was necessary for the future of their business. It's unclear whether the Peter Pan fleet in King Cove will have a buyer for their catch, and the move comes as the industry has seen prices plummet across the board. Despite a strong salmon season, the 2023 ex-vessel value for the fish was one of the lowest in nearly half a century when adjusted for inflation. And last month, one of the state's largest seafood processors, Trident, announced it would sell four plants, resulting in the loss of hundreds of jobs. Processors and other fishing organizations have cited both international and domestic market challenges as putting pressure on the industry. In October, the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute published a letter saying that the industry is experiencing a, quote, economic squeeze not seen for decades or longer. The letter said that much of Alaska's catch by value is exported, but foreign markets are flooded with Russian seafood. Exports to China, formerly a billion-dollar market, have also fallen by half. The letter also stated that domestic markets are down as consumers contend with high grocery prices. Gary Hennig, King Cove's longtime city administrator, said in a call to KDLG that the community was aware of the seafood industry's cash flow problems, but didn't expect something as drastic as a plant closure. Hennig said the closure would impact approximately one-third of the city's general fund budget from fish tax revenues loss. And that while the city has savings, long-term revenue loss is a concern. In Dillingham, I'm Christina McDermott.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in November proposed one of the largest changes to lead pipe regulations in three decades, including a requirement for every community to test their service lines and submit the results by April. As KRBD's Jack Darrell reports, Ketchikan's utility department is not sure that deadline is realistic.
Studies in recent years have linked lead in drinking water to lower IQ scores in children and higher risk of heart disease in adults. More often than not, that lead comes from old municipal pipes. According to Randy Bates, the director of the state's Department of Environmental Conservation Water Division, lead pipes are a much bigger problem in more industrialized parts of the country.
In general, Alaska's infrastructure is so much newer. We don't have as many lead service connections here in Alaska as other down south, more established long-term down south infrastructure.
But every community in the state is required to test their service lines just the same. The comprehensive results must be submitted to the state's DEC by April 24th. John Kleiniger is the Water Division Manager at Ketchikan Public Utilities. He says that getting it done in time will be a struggle for them and other water utilities across the state.
Yeah, we're going to be busy. We're working with an engineering consulting firm to help us put all the pieces together because, yeah, to have even a draft report prepared by April 24th, that's not much time.
And it's not just public service lines. It's the pipes on private properties, too. To pull this off in Ketchikan, Kleiniger began sending utility employees door-to-door, starting with the oldest structures in town first. First on the list was the Pioneer Hall, built in 1900.
And then working into the 10s, the 20s, and possibly into the 30s. And beyond then, or that, I don't think we're going to see anything other than some galvanized service lines, which, you know, might have been installed in the 40s during World War II.
Kleiniger says you don't need to wait for a knock at the door to find out if you have a lead service line in your house, though. You can do it yourself, but you might get a little bit dusty. He tells customers to first locate the incoming line, usually in the crawl space or underneath the house.
If you scratch it with, you know, a screwdriver or something like that, if it's lead, you'll see a, a shiny dark gray surface, whereas the rest of the lead service line is a dull gray.
Lead is soft as far as metals go. If a pipe is galvanized steel, scratching it with a screwdriver won't do much. Kleininger says if it's lead, you'll know. Or you can always send a picture to your local water utility to make sure. Kleininger says that as each Alaskan community rushes towards the April deadline, the money and man hours will add up, especially if infrastructure upgrades are needed. But Carrie Boham with the DEC says there's federal money to help. She says the state has funding through the EPA to provide loans as well as small grants.
If they do determine that they have lead service lines that need to be replaced, there's still 4 more years worth of those grant dollars, which are substantial, available for us to apply for.
The pot of funds is roughly $28 million over 5 years. After a draft review and comment period of Alaska's test results, the final inventory is due to the feds by October 16th. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
Alaska's sole U.S. Representative Mary Peltola visited Wrangell on December 30th. She met with city officials, the Wrangell Cooperative Association, and saw the site of the landslide.
When the sun came up, we were able to go and look at the landslide firsthand. And of course, nothing does it justice like seeing it firsthand.
In an interview after her visit, she says the Wrangell community is now focused on how to be better prepared for these events going forward. She says the number of national disasters is increasing nationwide. The Federal Emergency Management Agency was created to respond to just a few natural disasters per year. But Peltola says now we're seeing 25 to 30 natural disasters across America each year. She says the system isn't set up to carry this kind of load.
I think we recognize that you can never really be whole again after going through some of things like this. But we could certainly be doing a lot better.
She says ultimately Congress needs to give FEMA more resources, but that won't happen overnight. Also during the Wrangell visit, Peltola spoke about the landless legislation that Alaska's congressional delegation has reintroduced. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, passed in 1971, transferred millions of acres to Native corporations all across the state, but 5 communities in Southeast were left out so they could not form corporations. They include Wrangell, Petersburg, Ketchikan, Haines, and Tenakee Springs. The landless legislation would amend the bill to include these 5 communities. Support for the cause has grown. Some former opponents, like the Wilderness Society, now support it.
We're seeing more traction on the landless legislation than we ever have. It has gone through the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, and this is the furthest this legislation has ever gotten. So this is a victory for Alaskans, but we're not across the finish line yet. We're still looking. We have another year to get this across the finish line.
Peltola says that multiple groups have collaborated to move the landless bill forward, including the U.S. Forest Service, Wrangell's local tribe, the Wrangell Cooperative Association, and non-governmental organizations. Peltola says she thinks the 5 communities have missed out on a lot of economic growth, scholarship opportunities, and positive influences. But she says the land selection process is really tricky and time-consuming. The amount of federal land available to give the 5 communities has shrunk over the decades. Peltola says this won't be a very quick process, but it will be steps taken in the right direction. For Alaska State Troopers and other police departments across the North, the fur trapper hat is iconic. The State Department of Public Safety buys about 50 of them a year and is looking for a new supply. It has put out a request for proposals for hats with very specific requirements. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, the hats provide both warmth and cultural identity.
For Alaska State Troopers, the fur trapper hat is more than just head cover. Our uniform is rich in history and has a lot of meaning throughout the state. Austin McDaniel, the communications director for the Department of Public Safety, says the fur hats have been part of the uniform for decades. So we're looking for a black hat that's made of otter or beaver fur. A skull cap and ear covers is insulated up to negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit. The hats must also be lined with fleece, both windproof and waterproof, and unisex. McDaniel says troopers are still free to buy their own hats. About half of them prefer to have them locally made. Earl Samuelson, a retired trooper pilot from Nepusquiac, says after more than three decades with the department, he went through about five hats. He still volunteers for the Bethel Search and Rescue Team, so a good hat is still important.
Our area is harsh, so you got to have a really extreme cold weather hat.
Samuelson, who is UPIC, says the trooper-issued fur hats are not warm enough for snow machine rides on the coldest days and are more suited to springtime wear.
You don't have the correct hat or equipment, yeah, you can freeze your ears.
Samuelson says the hat must have a tight fit, which is why most troopers like to have them made just for them, because the tiniest leak can lead to frostbite. But Samuelson believes troopers also enjoy having that connection with native skin sewers. He says the hats are a source of pride.
People ask you, well, who made your cap? And you'll say, so-and-so, so-and-so.
Samuelson says most troopers prefer hats made out of sealskin because they're not as heavy as those made out of beaver, but still warm and waterproof. But Samuelson believes beaver provides the best protection. And that's the fur four Fairbanks police officers chose when they made their own beaver hats with the help of elders at Dinakinaga, a Fairbanks-based nonprofit. Sharon McConnell, the executive director for Dinakinaga, which means Our People Speak in Athabascan, says that the program is called Caps for Cops.
By the end of the project, they were calling the elders that taught them grandma. They even brought their kids in to meet with the elders.
McConnell says the elders treated the officers with respect, which they return. And the result for Officer Clint Brubeck was a hat he's proud to wear.
Not only beautiful, but functional.
But it's much more than headgear.
I think the biggest takeaway from making these hats were the relationships built.
Brubeck worked with Marie Yaska, an elder in her 80s, originally from the interior Athabascan community of Hoosliep. She nicknamed him Broken Needles in her language because he broke two of her sewing machine needles. Brubeck admits his workmanship is far from perfect, but says every time he puts on his beaver hat, he thinks of the stories she shared with him, like how she learned to read by deciphering the letters on cardboard boxes that brought goods to the community and later were used for insulation. Stories that make his hat more than just a hat. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Taxpayers in Alaska will not be part of a program to directly file federal taxes with the IRS. In October, the IRS announced the new pilot program in which people could directly file their federal taxes with the agency for free instead of using a third-party tax preparer like TurboTax. At the time, Alaska was listed as a potential state to take advantage of the program since there are no state income taxes. However, Alaska was excluded from the list of 12 states eligible for the program announced late last month. In a statement, IRS officials said, although Alaska doesn't have a state income tax, quote, the direct file pilot does not support reporting the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend for federal income tax reporting purposes, close quote. An IRS spokesman declined to answer further questions on Alaska's exclusion from the pilot program.
The racial wealth gap in the U.S. is wider today than it was when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. I'm Nova Safa with this special Marketplace Minute for MLK Day. The gap in wealth between white and black Americans was closing in 1968, albeit slowly. But starting in the 1980s, it began widening. That's according to a 2022 paper by economists at Princeton and the University of Bonn in Germany. By May of last year, researchers at the Rand Corporation reported that the median white household in the U.S. had $189,000 in savings, investments, home equity, and other wealth, while the median black household had just $24,000 in total wealth. I'm Nova Safa with this special Marketplace Minute for MLK Day.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 15th day of January, the year 2023. The sun rose at 9:41 this morning. It will set again at 4:56, giving us 7 hours and 15 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 3 minutes and 15 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high temperature for this date was 45 degrees, set in 1916, 1924, and 1963, and a record low was minus 8, set in Chile, 1975. Currently 35 degrees under fair skies. The wind is beginning to kick up a bit. Out at the airport, they are showing northwest wind steady at 15, gusting to 23, and they have 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for sunny skies for the rest of the week, at least through Friday, and mostly sunny skies on Saturday with a chance of snow. Snow is likely on Sunday. Northwest winds to about 15 for today and tomorrow. It's supposed to come up to 15 or 25 on Tuesday night, and gusts as high as 35 on Wednesday. Looking at our local tides, we have an incoming tide. Our next high tide here on the east side will be at 4:31 this afternoon and be 8.9 feet, followed by a low tide at 10:58 p.m., about 11 p.m., of minus 7/10. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 5:04 p.m. and be 14.2 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 11:32 p.m. of minus 8/10. Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 miles. North 10 today, except northwest 20 north of Dangerous Cape. 6-foot seas building to 7 feet tonight and tomorrow. For tomorrow night, north 30 seas to 9 feet. And for Wednesday, north 40 seas to 11 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, northwest 20 becoming northeast this afternoon with seas to 4 feet. For tonight and tomorrow, northeast 20 seas to 5 feet. And for tomorrow night, north winds to 30 knots, seas to 7 feet. Wednesday through Thursday in the Shelikof, north 30 seas to 10 feet. The Kodiak Public Library will be closed tomorrow, today, for Martin Luther King Jr. Day, if you were thinking of stopping by today. Tomorrow is the next installment of Planning for Life's Changes, which is a four-part series put on by the Kodiak College and Hospice and Palliative Care of Kodiak. This one is focusing on tips and tricks for organizing important documents. Always important, especially if you're thinking about putting together a go bag. That's happening tomorrow at 6 to 8 p.m. at the college in the Benny Benson Building, room 129. Deb Holden Engvall will talk about various ways to organize your important documents. Whether you use old-school pen and paper or are completely digital, this is the class for you. You'll talk about what kinds of documents to get organized and options for organizing them. Change happens, whether there is a fire, tsunami, retirement, or serious injury or illness or end of life. Start the new year off right by getting prepared for any of life's changes. And again, that's happening Tuesday, January 16th, tomorrow, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Kodiak College in the Benny Benson Building. On Wednesday, the Planning and Zoning Commission will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers. That's happening at 6:30 p.m. On Thursday, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having its regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers, also at 6:30 p.m. Both meetings are open to the public, and the packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough's website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 with any questions. And calling all Kodiak's agricultural enthusiasts, the Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District wants to hear from chicken farmers, ranchers, growers, gardeners, everybody. Let's talk about the challenges of agriculture in Kodiak and the solutions people have developed. Also about future workshops that might be helpful. And it includes a brief program available to assist agriculture producers in Kodiak. That's all happening February 1st at the Kodiak Public Library, 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. Feel free to join anytime you can. Again, that's February 1st, 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.